All right, everybody. We are down to the last session in the Demand-Gen track. I want to thank everybody for attending this track over the last couple days. It's been good to see you get taking a lot of notes and learning a lot of ideas, and I appreciate all the speakers coming up. We have one more session for you, and Stacy from Bottomline and Leslie from Optum are going to, Leslie's going to take you through a case study and share with you one of the experiences she had recently in terms of some of the campaign work, and then I'm going to put some questions forward to both of them, and if there's time, we'll let you guys ask some questions as well. So let me let them get started, and I'll join them in just a little bit.
Well, good afternoon. Nice to be here in sunny Scottsdale. I'm going to take just a few minutes. I'm going to go through these slides really quick. I only have a handful of them, but I'm going to tell you a story about the evolution of a campaign that we've been executing at Optum for about the past 6-7 months. It's a three-step process. So it started with the introduction of Optum IQ, which is our new and first ingredient brand at Optum. So I just moved this slide up because I thought I had it at the end, and I thought, gosh, you probably all want to know what is Optum IQ, like the rest of the world. So Optum IQ is our new ingredient brand. Basically, it describes our data intelligence, our data and analytics, healthcare intelligence. It's like Intel inside. It's embedded in the majority of all the products and services that we sell at Optum. Going head-to-head with a competitor like IBM Watson. Do we have any IBM Watson people here? No? Oh, good. Okay. we felt the need at Optum to brand our data and analytics so we could really establish ourselves as the leader in this space in the market. So that's Optum IQ. So this campaign started, the first phase of it, with a live stream event we called Data in Focus. So this is it was a reveal campaign and basically a big webinar. And we used email, some social media, pay-per-click, some retargeting, a few poll tactics like that. For the most part, email. We sent out 1 million a month over a 2-month period of time from our internal databases to build awareness of it. You'll see a few, this is a real eye chart, but we ended up with 4,100 people attending this live stream, and we had 1,200 in the audience live at our Optum Forum conference where we live streamed it from. Some really great stats here with it, 78% continuing to watch over an hour, 69% stayed through the full 90 minutes, which is really compelling considering that we didn't tell people what this webinar was going to be about. The whole concept of data in focus was bringing data in focus. So it was a reveal campaign where through our emails, we revealed a little bit more each week about what they could expect to see when they logged in for the live stream. So very interesting that we had results like that. From there, a few more stats, lots of impressions, and lots of views. From there, we moved into what we called the interim drip campaign. So this was phase two of the launch of Optum IQ, where we would send out a piece of thought leadership content every other week to the engaged audience that had registered for the live stream. So we did a few poll tactics as well. There were some social media, some blogs, a little bit of paid placement, not too much. But basically, we wanted to see how engaged was this audience that had watched our live stream? How interested were they in the content that we were putting out? And could we test different types of content from across the organizations? We're a really big company, and we target just about everybody in some way, shape, or form, different industries. So we have payers, providers, government, life sciences, pharmaceutical, et cetera. So a lot of audiences out there. It's hard to create content when it has to be at that level that everybody's interested in it. So that's what we tested through the interim campaign. That campaign, I just put up a few stats, had some amazing results. We were able to see, I put the comparison data at the top there, but our benchmark data, our opens are about 10%, our click-through rate's just under 1%, click-to-opens about 8%. With this interim campaign, we're seeing 32% open rates If the content was not gated, we're seeing 56% open rates, with form completion rates at 47%. So those are some pretty compelling numbers. That tells us that we have a really engaged audience, and we took that strategy now as we move into phase three of OptimIQ. So I'm super excited about this. This campaign launches next week on Wednesday. You'll see it in market. You'll start to see the new creative, which is very different than any other creative we've ever used at Optum. And we basically built a structure. This is just a snapshot of what we call a plan on a page. So as we're building a big integrated marketing campaign, where do we start and how do we build it out to understand what we want to achieve, who we want to target, how are we going to target them, all those questions we have to answer as marketers. We have one objective for this campaign, and that's to establish in the market that Optum's the leader in healthcare data and analytics. We have only two goals, really. You'll see three, but that's just internal communications. It's not the external fund marketing part. But this is an awareness campaign at heart. So we are looking to build awareness first, generate leads second. So that's a different strategy for our organization. And then, of course, there's multiple strategies that will help us achieve those goals and different measurements that we've put in place. We have defined our personas. Always important. I always like to throw that in, even if it doesn't fit with what I'm talking about, because I think it's really important for us to understand who we're marketing to help us better understand how we're targeting. Our strategies for this campaign will be to launch the enterprise-wide as our first enterprise-wide thought leadership campaign that will sit below our master brand campaign, but outside of our specific segment campaigns, of which we have dozens and dozens. We will integrate key elements of this campaign into segment campaigns for congruency. So all of our segment partners, payer, provider, government, life sciences, all of our different industries that are markets that we target, will leverage the content from IQ, and vice versa. We'll curate it from them as well so we can help promote that segment level content as well. We're going to use an integrated approach, lots of different tactics, and also offer a subscription to OptimIQ content. This has worked really well with other campaigns that we've had, and so we're pulling that into this one. We're going to have a strong PR component to this. Earned media will be very important. And then, of course, we have to align with our master brand. And that's all I have.
All right. Thanks for sharing that. I'm going to come join you guys on stage. Make the same leap that you did. Chop in with a question for Stacey in just a minute, but one of the things that I noticed that I want to chat with you a little bit about, I think the way that Leslie shows the waterfall metrics, you know, there's some really big numbers there. Some of you probably don't have the audience size that Optum has, where you know you're running campaigns and you're not getting thousands or even tens of thousands of results. And when you see those waterfall metrics where someone, you know, click through, respond, a form submit, all the way down, you know, going from 10,000 to 800, some of you are probably thinking about, well, I can't get enough responses with a funnel of that diameter. And one of the trends that we've been seeing, especially with the companies doing more account-based marketing, those funnels don't work. Those funnels where the massive numbers at the top and the small numbers at the bottom, you're never going to get to your growth goal. So I just want to share with you that if you're doing much more target account marketing, that you're not going to see those kind of metrics. What you will see are the same typical responses. And so one of the questions I want to ask Stacey is what are you typically seeing when in your campaigns in terms of success metrics that you've experienced?
Let me think about that one. We are seeing a lot of success and engagement with our customers and our subscription base when we speak to them in a way that makes sense for them. And I'll give it an example. We service multiple lines of business at Bottom Line. There's five that our marketing team services. And we've stood up two customer engagement engines or long-term nurture strategies. But the difference is we've set up one that's persona-based. So we have five unique audiences that we're speaking to. And it's a bi-monthly drop. We've seen 3x the impressions and engagements. It's a wonderful opportunity for our team to speak to our audience and address their pain points. But then on the flip side, we've set up another CEE that is our customer engagement engine that is lead score based. And that's been a really interesting contrast because we have such this large subscription base of early stage engagers, and we're taking them down a content track that makes sense for them. And then we've got obviously a very smaller, much smaller pool of contacts that are super engaged and ready to buy, and we've sent them down in a completely different track. And the metrics are really showing us that our audience needs this differentiation. I think we all know that, but to see it when we're speaking to them and as it relates to pain points and then speaking to them as to where they are in the buyer's journey, those are two very different projects. And we've really seen our engagement metrics just go through the roof. We've seen pipeline conversion at a much quicker rate. So some happiness going on there. Okay.
And are you, like Leslie, seeing how the kinds of thousands or tens of thousands respondents to your campaigns? Are you dealing with that large of a base?
No, we really don't. And to your point, we work in a very finite market, especially in the line of business that I support. So we do take a little bit more of an ABM approach, but we don't have that enormous funnel, which would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But we're looking at more, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 to 5,000, and that's the kind of the top of our funnel.
There's some models on the web, I think on our blog, there's some tools that you can download. So let's say, for example, to put this in perspective, that your company wants to do 10 million next year. And I won't do the math really fast, but because I'm not Rain Man, but if you want to do 10 million in net new revenue and your average deal size was $100,000, you know, how many deals do you need to generate 10 million of new business? And so then you're like, okay, so that's the average deal size. Well, if I'm converting 2%, then you bump up the funnel and up the funnel and up the funnel, and then pretty much you're looking at like 100,000 at the top, and you're like, the math doesn't work. I can't get 100,000 responses to a campaign. So that's what I'm trying to put in perspective, that if you are going to, after a set of target accounts, those traditional waterfall metrics, they just don't pan out. So you want to be tracking everything, obviously, as you know, but just give that some consideration. Let's go back over to you, Leslie, in terms of like looking forward this year. What are some of the things that you're looking forward to do campaign-wise now that you've had these behind you and some of the success there?
Yeah, so one thing that we're putting in place, again, Optum, big company, lots of different campaigns going on. They're all different sizes, as you're talking about, depending on what it is that we're bringing to market. This is the biggest thing that I just showed you that we've ever brought to market. So it's the most grand example that I could give. But there's a lot of smaller, more niche examples as well. What we're doing in-house is we're putting together this year for the first time ever a campaign director community, we're calling it, where we are pulling together all of our campaign directors from across the organization, all the different segments that they support, and we're building a community where we can share our best practices. It will help with our continued education. I mean, certainly we attend events like this, but we don't do it together. We don't have a community, and in this big organization, it's amazing when you get us together. We had our first campaign director meeting last week. And it was the first time in the history of the company that they've brought together all of us who are building and executing campaigns so that we could learn from each other. So we decided to build a community out of that and formalize that process. That's a big one for us.
Those of you, it was yesterday, I was talking about video after Schneider Electric came up. You saw actually a video in another session of theirs, which was just a pure coincidence. And then Evan yesterday was sharing that slice of life video. So I'm curious, by a show of hands, how many of you are currently using video in your marketing programs? Raise your hands. A lot of you. That's great. And of that group, raise your hand again if you're producing those videos in-house, like within your own marketing team. Let's see that. So about half. Some of you are still outsourcing that or using maybe an agency for it. So question for both of you. I can start with you if you want. What, in terms of different type of campaign formats and content assets, what's the mix look like for you going forward? What are you trying?
And I love the way that everyone raised their hand with video, because I really think that is important and it's very impactful. I think one of the fun things that we're doing with video is translating it into what we're calling teaser videos. So if we have a very robust white paper, but we need to use it cross-channel, we're generating teaser videos, which are 30 seconds. You know, this is why it's so magical and you want to download it and download it now. And we've seen great success there. I really like that format. And then on the webinar side, I will say, I think everyone in this room can say that we hate webinars. Like, they're such a heavy lift, but let's just face it, they translate, right? They translate into revenue, and so it is an important tactic for us to continue doing. But from a bottom line perspective, we've been very much more tactful in how we execute them and with whom. So we've been doing a lot of third-party sponsorship where we have a name brand that we know resonates with our audience, and we're partnering with them on webinars. And then if we're going to do an internal webinar, we're very diligent about getting multiple customers on board or a strategic or a thought leader that can join us as well. Where we feel like webinars are not working for us is when it's a look at me opportunity. And I think we all know that, but so often the business asks that of us. But doing less webinars that may be a bit heavier on the budget side, but they have performed much better for us by, you know, engaging third parties and thought leaders.
Before I have Leslie take that, on the webinars, I'm curious, and maybe you guys are as well, historically, webinars have been like, it's on March 7th at 10 a.m., and there's campaigns leading up to it. You conduct the webinar, and then you do a follow-up to the people that have missed it. We're seeing more and more trend with our clients that they produce the webinar, record the webinar, and then market the webinar's availability as opposed to getting people to pre-reg for it. I'm curious what you're both doing there. Where do we want to start?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that. So we're definitely doing that. I'd say we still...
Which one?
The latter of the two. It's so much more flexible to create the webinar, create the content the way we want in a controlled environment, and where we can what's the word, just kind of dictate what how we want it to go and have control over editing it, et cetera, versus the idea of promoting it and leaving a one-time slot that people can come. We did that with the drip campaign. Here's a great example. We put out, our payer division put out a webinar. They promoted the heck out of it, and it was a set day and time, and they got, 150 people to come attend their webinar. We took that on-demand webinar through the drip campaign. We promoted it with, a regular email, some supporting content with social, et cetera. And we got about 500 people to attend that webinar. It took one outreach to just blow the numbers out of the water. And it was because it was on demand versus a set time where people could come. It's just much more flexibility.
What about you, Stacey?
Well, I agree with Leslie that is much more of where we're all going. We did do an interesting application with a customer forum, so it was more of an internal webinar where we had to keep it very close to us. But we also needed to do a product demo that we were all a little worried about. So we recorded it, edited everything, and then marketed it as a live webinar, opened in the tech from a technology perspective. It gave me almost a heart attack. But at the end of it, we opened up a live Q&A. So it felt very live, but we had actually recorded what was the demo part, so we knew that was going to go, but we still had the interactivity at the end.
It's clever. I mentioned, I think yesterday, I do a podcast, Demand Gen Radio, and when I first launched the podcast, it was a bit more of that format where it was every other Thursday at 9:30 Pacific, and they would insert a commercial to it, so I had to keep my content to like 12 and a half minutes, and then the commercial in 12 and a half minutes, and it was, I just felt so restricted in when to produce the content. So I stopped that, and I just started recording podcasts whenever I could have a guest on the podcast and push them out. The numbers have gone through the roof. I can talk for 35 minutes or 40 minutes or 12 minutes, depending on whatever the content is. So think about freeing yourself from some of those constraints. One of the reasons I don't love event marketing is it's game on, right? Nothing can go wrong because it's happening for Andrew and the team right now. And if you're launching a webinar and it's at a certain time, what if you have a technical difficulty, right? You can't get over that. Your point about let's make the content more efficient. If we record it and edit it, we can get a bit more better format. Last question I have for you guys, and then if you guys have any questions, ask the experts, learn from your peers, is about where you're marketing. So many marketers market at the top of the funnel. And I asked the question in the workshop on Monday. I said, what percent of your revenue, is it more than 50% of your revenue comes from your install base? And almost everybody's hand went up. But if we look at what we do every single day, we spend so much time at the top of the funnel with net new, yet there's so much revenue to be generated, an massive company with tons of different products and services. So I'm curious, I guess the question is, what are you doing in terms of looking at different areas of the funnel? And is there any pressure by the organization to concentrate in certain areas? Who wants to go first?
Let me take that one first.
Okay.
I think at bottom line, we do a really solid job of top of the funnel. It just kind of runs, I mean, we put a lot of hard work into it, but it really runs itself. For example, one of our lines of business, we're producing 65% of the early stage pipeline value. So that's great. Like, the engine's humming, it's great. And much we used to talk about direct to sales leads or where leads went to die. Sometimes I feel our opportunities go to die in stage one or two, right? And that's where we've handed it over to the sales team. We've made that handshake and we've said, okay, now it's yours to go. I think that's now where a lot of things are stalling, and now where we are putting more focus in our content, more focus in just demand power, in, I don't want to say better alignment, but a more solid handshake with sales and how we can help them move those. And I really think that, you know, if we can progress these leads to a stage of RFP, that's really as far as we can go. But what we're finding out is they really do need our help in doing that. So BANT qualification is wonderful. It's feeding the engine, but they're looking for us to say, okay, once that BANT is there, what is the next stage? And that's where things like test drives are coming. I mean, it's a webinar, but if they can actually see the product at mass scale, that really helps our reps. We're doing some ROI tools. We've done a video, an auto demo where we actually, it's a short form video where we show them the product. And those are really helping the sales team move them along.
So you have a short form demo, few minutes, that like 3 to 5 minute form factor. And then there's a longer recorded demo as well that if somebody wanted more. Okay.
Right.
Great. What about you, Leslie?
Yeah, I would say that we have a structure at Optum behind how we interact, A, with our growth office. So at what point can we turn over leads? We know anything that comes in the top of our funnel is an inquiry. And it, we don't even call it a prospect until it's probably hit stage three of the buyer journey. And at that point is when we are handing it over to teleprospecting to qualify the lead. And they then will reach out to that prospect and they will qualify them. And if they qualify, then they're an MQL. All of the segments have MQL goals attached to their performance. There's a certain number that need to be hit every year for each of the segments for all of the campaigns. That's the primary objective. So that's the process that we follow. I think doing a gap analysis of content, I can't think of an organization, I hope one of you has one, that has in place, feels like they have content that aligns to each persona at every part of the buyer journey. So you know exactly what you're gonna do on your map. That is so difficult to do, but so critical. We've been doing gap analysis across the organization for that content and trying to map, map the journey. We're really good at the upper funnel too, that's easy. getting the net, you know, we're all good at that. But it's what do you do with them to nurture them through that buyer journey, that is where it becomes, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road.
And is product marketing part of your marketing team? Is that integrated or a separate group?
It's a separate group.
Yeah.
So we're very integrated, but we have segment marketing and portfolio marketing. Segments lead gen, portfolios, product marketing. So we have virtual teams that we put together to connect the two lines, but that's how we're structured.
I see it both ways, and it's such a critical integration because the product marketing people really should have the expertise on knowing what the best content is at different stages of the buying process, helping with persona definition. I mean, they own the products. They really should be, you know, if they're not in the ivory tower and they're out in the world with customers, they really know what content works best. That's the case. Sometimes I see it inside marketing and not.
Yeah, I have one comment on that. We use a term to separate the two when we're trying to describe to people what are the differences between, how come they're not together? That's weird. Segment marketing or portfolio marketing decides what's in the ad, so to speak. What is the content? What's in the, you know, what is the message? Segment marketing decides where is it going to go? Where are we going to put it? What are the strategies to get that message out into market? So at its very core, but you know, it gets muddy because everybody feels like they have a little bit of ownership on that content as well. But that's simply how it is. Yeah.
I remember meeting Leslie's team like 4 years ago, and they were just doing batch and blast marketing back then. There was no nurtures, there was no marketing while you sleep, and things have changed a lot there. I don't know, Stacey, are you guys doing nurturing as well, the mid-funnel automated marketing?
We are, great. We are, yes. And to Leslie's point, it's just do or die to have your content map and to find the gaps. And that's your speed to market, because when you're constantly trying to fill those gaps in real time, you just lose weeks and weeks. And if it's completed ahead of time, early in the year, and you all are marching to it, you're just that much quicker into market.
Right. When you guys see these funnels, there's no gravity in a funnel, right? And we, even though the metrics, like I love the slide that you showed that said, well, this is how many responses we had at the top and this is how much it netted down to, there is that attrition and that flow that way. But when you're generating demand, I don't think any of us really feel like we can architect and influence the buyer's journey truly, right? The buyers are going to engage with us when they're ready to engage. The content may educate them and move them down a psychological buying process. They've gone from awareness of this product to, okay, my needs are being met, addressed, I'm ready to make a purchase. So there is always the awareness, interest, desire, action, but we don't know exactly when that's happening. What we should be doing is inventorying our demand. Here's the inquiries, the people that have not had much engagement with us, and then here's the marketing qualified leads, the people that are showing through their digital body language and what they've done. If you're attending a webinar, you're interested, you know, unless it's a piece of content that doesn't relate to your products or services at all. Well, I'm going to end there with my questions for you two and see what questions you have. Go ahead.
I can take that. As David said, we met several years ago when we were throwing spaghetti against the wall, and we came back from this very conference when it was very small, and we reorganized our marketing team around the idea of content marketing. I mean, totally changed our way of thinking. It was crazy. But what it did, it was allowed us to put our first lead nurture campaign in place for the organization. We weren't doing it anywhere at Optum. And so we learned from that, and we were able to show and prove from the marketing level up that lead nurture was critical, and it worked. And this is how it worked and why it worked. And then we just got better. I mean, we were very linear. It started very linear. But we got better and better at it. And now it's highly intricate.
And I think you have to ask the question of what's the risk of nurturing early stage ops, or what's the risk in speaking to your audience from a thought leadership perspective once they're deeper in the funnel? If you want to stay top of mind, you want to be relevant, you want to be known in the space, why when they get into the funnel is that when you stop that's when you stop speaking to them? It's almost counterintuitive. So it was a little bit of a force feed, like we're the marketing experts here and we're not going to offer your contacts anything offensive. We're not, you know, we're here to help. So I do think it is a little bit of a force feed and a little bit of watch and learn. At the same time, I always have to pose the question is, of what harm is a white paper or an infographic gonna do with your later stage opportunities?
My recommendation would try to tie your achievements further down the funnel than top of funnel, because anybody can game the system and generate more leads, and that's when it's all your leads suck because you're chasing volume, and your leads are going to suck when you're chasing volume. But if you had a quantifiable metric lower down the funnel, say, well, we'll generate a shared view of what a marketing qualified lead is, or marketing will contribute this much to pipeline, and push those numbers down, it's going to help you personally. It's going to help move from being the arts and crafts new logo department to, you know, actual revenue drivers.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to add that I think it's also important to understand your sales cycle, because our sales cycle is really long for these big giant deals. They can take years to close. So the idea of nurturing with thought leadership, you know, that lead nurture track might be much longer. And the risk that we run in the ever-changing and fast-changing world, especially with social media and how news gets out so fast, is that we start to confuse our buyer. And, you know, because what we delivered in the first white paper that got them in, and now we're nurturing and we're giving him new information 8 months later, and all of a sudden he's like, well, now what do I do? So it's making sure, again, that we're mapping the other content that we're giving them along the way, so we're not doing that.
Great. Well, thanks, everybody. I'm sure there's more questions, but you guys have one more general session, and I want to make sure you have time to get over there for that. I believe it's James Taylor from C-School is going to be talking about creative and how it applies to the world of AI. So thank you, Stacy, and thank you, Leslie, for sharing your words of wisdom, and thank you, everybody.